Welcome to Asians Do Therapy. This week I had the pleasure of speaking with J.S. Park. He might need no introduction for those who are on Instagram. He's a hospital chaplain, author, and online educator. We talk about his process of becoming a chaplain, his experiences in therapy and with medication, the losses of assimilation, and his upcoming book on grief, and much more. A content warning. We speak of suicide and a suicide attempt from around minutes 13 to 26. If you are having suicidal thoughts, please share with a trusted person or call 988 or text 741-741. I hope you find our conversation hopeful, comforting. And here's my conversation with June. Listened to some of your interviews and read parts of your book. I'm curious about your path to becoming a chaplain. Like, how did that come about?
In college, I changed my major several times, and then I finally landed on psych, and I wanted to actually be a therapist originally. And then I almost made this sort of sideways turn into seminary. Yeah, I was going to church at the time, and I'm almost embarrassed to say, I think I was still an atheist at the time, but the church offered me a scholarship. And this is me, I guess, taking advantage of privilege and opportunity. I thought I can go to seminary and still help people. And so it surprised my parents, went to seminary, became a pastor, and it was not like I thought it would be. The pastoral ministry was very difficult for me. I think the church world, I grew up an atheist. So when I entered the church world, it was just completely the opposite of what I understood God and scripture to be. And so I think about almost 7 years later, I was on good terms with the church that I was at, but I decided to go. And when I left, I wasn't sure what else to do because, like, with an MDiv, there's an old joke, the Masters of Divinity you get from seminary, an MDiv is more like an MDon't. he can't do much with it. So I applied to a bunch of places, but I found out about chaplaincy, which is almost like a pastor, except they work outside of the church. And so they work in prison or military or law enforcement, and especially at the hospital. And so I found out about the program because I had the MDiv. I was actually able to get in the program, and it was a 6-month internship and a year-long residency. So whereas in church, I always felt like this oddball there, like I was looking in through a window, seeing people do church stuff. And I just never felt like I ever fit into the church world at all. But when I got into chaplaincy, I remember my first clinical, and I accompanied a physician in the emergency room to a private waiting room where we told a family that their loved one had just died. And I remember their grief, of course, was very expressive, very loud, understandably so. And the physician left, and I was there with the family to offer next steps, to offer comfort and consolation. And I remember at the end of that visit thinking, this is exactly where I belong. This is exactly where I want to be. And I'm so lucky because, you know, very few people in life, I think, find the place where they can say, I belong here. My calling, my gifting, my experience, even maybe some of my trauma, all of it fit together to, I guess, turn me into, fit together the ingredients to become a vessel for the room that I'm in. And so I'm so glad that I found that and that there's a role for that. And so I sort of fit at that now, that intersection of mental health and faith and also grief and crisis.
It's so interesting. You know, we talk about like finding our path, or, but sometimes we don't know. We just keep going, right? Because it felt like for you, you just kept going. I went to seminary school, became a pastor, and then things just happen and leads you to this thing that maybe you had not anticipated. I think very few people know exactly what they wanted to be when they were, I don't know, 20 or something like that. So I think it's a path that keeps unfolding over time.
Yeah, you know, and people start over every day. If we're lucky to have the resources, we can do that and re-career ourselves. I mean, my father-in-law became an acupuncturist like much later in life. I mean, Our calling can change at any time. I think calling is very flexible. Calling is very pliable. So thought, I'm called to the church. I got to do this forever. But I was in a good place when I left, but I decided I can do something else. And I was very lucky that I could.
And you mentioned this a little bit about being a priest, a mix between a priest and a therapist. What do you mean exactly between the therapist and the priest?
As a chaplain, when I walk into a room at the hospital, of course, very often I'm walking into the worst day of this person's life, sometimes the worst moment. And I think I have the capacity, flexibility, and range to be able to, if they want to, talk about their faith. But as a chaplain who sees anyone regardless of religion or background, and I don't consider myself primarily religious first, we can also talk about mental health. We can talk about their day. We can talk about the crisis that they're experiencing. And so I can kind of shift between lanes. And so I make that joke that I'm a cross between a priest and a therapist, that they're a priest. So if they want communion, or if they want to talk about God, or how much they hate God or disbelieve God right now, I can do that. If they want to talk about their mental health and the crisis, I can support them through their crisis. I make it sound like they're separate things, but actually, faith and mental health, spirituality and our own, emotional well-being are very, very tied together. They're layered and woven together, and I don't think they should be separate.
Sometimes I think that a lot of our anxiety is about meaning and death and maybe a spiritual question.
Yeah, a lot of the patients that I see, when we're faced with our own mortality, when we're faced with, suffering, illness, injury, just like you're saying, we start encountering and asking those existential and philosophical questions. I think it's spiritual in nature, but the language that is used is not always religious language. People can just start asking questions because I think naturally we are meaning making. We take patterns and schemas, we see out of an event that happened, we attempt to make meaning out of it, even if that is to say that this thing is. Life is haphazard, chaotic, and senseless. This tragedy shouldn't have happened. Even if that's what we ascribe to it, we try to make sense out of that crisis. And I think part of my role, and also part of the long-term care of a therapist, what they would do, and I think even what a priest or pastor might do, is almost like hold a candle to the floor so they can see a little bit further down the road. I don't want to tell them what to do or impart or impose any meaning. But sort of be alongside them and help them see a little bit further. And one big difference between chaplains and pastors, pastors preach, but chaplains are a presence. And so I assume that the patient that I see, that they often carry the answers to their own questions. And what in their pre-existing framework, whether they be Muslim, Jewish, Hindu, Buddhist, Christian, or atheist, what in their framework will give them the coping that they need right now. And if it's incomplete or there's a gap, in what way can I help to illuminate that so that those questions can be answered? But yeah, anytime we're faced with that grief mortality, I've seen it now hundreds of times, we start asking those questions. And sometimes it is just me sitting in the why, and that's all I can do.
I've heard you speak of this, the definition of a chaplain is a non-judgmental, non-anxious presence. People are like, oh, and you're a therapist, or like you're just listening. But it's so hard to listen with presence and non-judgment as much as one can, and non-ang because there's so much happening in someone's suffering, that it's hard just to be present with them.
Yeah, because Ian, I'm sure like we as providers or caregivers or quote unquote professionals, we come in with our own ideas and stories and background and upbringing, all of it, right? And so there's part of that that we almost have to like not set aside, but keep close. It's almost like that's part of our gifting, but not in a way that would be imposed or used against this patient of ours. And so that's kind of the non-anxious part of it. And the non-judgmental part of it is not to moralize what this person is going through. Because sometimes you may have a client or patient who tells you a wild story of how they got where they are. And some of the choices they made, you're thinking, I don't know if I would have made those choices, you know? And if they're telling their story, and if you so much as just raise your eyebrows like that, like I just did, if they say something, you know, and then they say some choice that they made that got them in a lot of trouble or harmed themselves or someone, and you just kind of go like that, that's a non-judgmental, you know, nonverbal right cue right there. And they suddenly may withdraw a little bit and close up a little bit. And so part of that, and you know this already, I'm just telling you things you know, but part of that active listening is having that non-judgmental, almost stillness, almost bringing a calm where you're really listening and tuned in, and there's not a fiber in your being where even if internally you're thinking, you know, wow, what a story. But outside, we're showing an empathy and a compassion that is still with them. And we may end up being the only person in their life who does not judge them for how they got where they are. And that's such an important role.
Yeah, my eyebrows give me away all the time. Like before Zoom, I didn't realize
Well,
what
you know,
they
I mean, since 2020, I still wear a mask in patients' rooms.
Yeah.
Yeah, so luckily this helps a little bit, but even the yeah, the eyes, you know what I
Yeah.
mean, yeah.
Yeah. I could feel my nervousness in asking this because it's maybe a bit taboo or something we don't like to talk about, but I think it feels important for us to talk about in terms of like I was reading that suicide rates were the highest last year in 2023 in the US, the highest ever. And then for the Asian American community, for certain age groups, it's also the leading cause of suicide. I think people from the 15 to 24 age group and women above 65. So it's alarming rates. And just from reading your work, I know not only have you thought of it had suicidal thoughts, but there was an attempt and that you were hospitalized. So I think I'm wanting maybe to share whatever you want to, or can or feel you would like people to know about that time in your life, what was happening.
I've been now on medication for a little over 3 years. I think, honestly, I should have been on it sooner. Depression, suicidal ideation, that was something I've experienced for as long as I can remember. And I honestly thought that that was normal. I mean, I thought about taking my life every single day, even if it was just a random intrusive thought. I would think about it, even sadly, I would fantasize about it, and I would think about people at my funeral and things like that. And it was every day, sometimes multiple times a day. And once I started taking medication, I found the right one. This was around the end of 2020. I remember going weeks without any of those kind of thoughts. And I remember one day thinking, I haven't had those thoughts in weeks. And I also started regular, consistent therapy at the end of 2020. I had it before, but it was more intermittent. You know, I would go on and off. So I think with the therapy and with the medication, both which I was very lucky to have the resources for, those thoughts became much more manageable when they happen. And I can go weeks now without it, to the point where my last therapist just retired. I got a new one. And she thinks, you know, after evaluating me, that my depression is not even really a problem anymore because I can go a long time without thinking about it. But yeah, to your earlier point, back in 2003, I did have an attempt in my own life. And honestly, when I think about it now, there's some, it shouldn't be, but there's some embarrassment and shame around it. Because at the time, there was a girl that I was really in love with. She broke up with me, and I didn't think I could live anymore. Now, I have to question, was it because of the girlfriend breaking up with me, or was it more of a question of, am I a valuable person now that someone doesn't want me, or am I not valuable anymore? And I think what was buried under the surface of about my worth, about who I am as a person, just exploded. And the depression just consumed me. And so, in a moment of just being lost in that, I swallowed like half a bottle of pills, like painkillers. And so I called a friend to say goodbye. He came over immediately and took me to the hospital. And so I was Baker Acted, which for those who don't know, a Baker Act is a mandatory 72-hour hold in some states, including Florida, in which law enforcement and or hospital has to hold you. Usually law enforcement will take you and then take you to hospital. So I was, and we use it as a verb, I guess, in the hospital, Baker acted. I was Baker acted for not the full 72 hours because they determine, I kind of said this was hopefully a one-time thing. And so they determined it's okay, go early. But I was sent to some place where I was with a lot of other people with mental health issues. And gosh, what a difficult time that was to really come to encounter how much of my own thinking about my own self-worth was just really, really, it was, I was not whole. I don't think it was about the breakup. I think it was about what it said about me and that it verified or confirmed that I was somehow not valuable. So I spent a lot of time trying to, put myself back together, 2003. And really, it was just the last few years, actually, that I kind of came to grips with, well, what are the thoughts that are leading me there, And certainly there are biological components to it, the psychosocial model, it's kind of the three-part model about where our trauma and depression and mental health stuff comes from. But I think even the biological part of it has a lot to do with the way that we're socialized and the way that we experience trauma and how that affects us. And my ACE score is like a 9 out of 10, my adverse childhood experiences. I'm very high. And so I'm sure that had a lot to do with my depression. But when I think about what you mentioned about Asian Americans, why is our suicide rate so high? Even in South Korea, I think we're still like number 11 in the world. I think about it's a multi-layered, complex issue that I don't think can be pinpointed on any one thing, because I think the very westernized take on Eastern culture is, wow, they're conformists, and they're just very passive and quiet. And that's what makes them start having these thoughts, because they can't speak up for themselves and that kind of thing. And I don't want to give a westernized take, on Eastern culture, because when I look at South Korea in our history, we've always spoken up and advocated for ourselves and protested. It's not, that's not true. That's just kind of one Western single story about that. So I don't want to generalize. Certainly, there is something about how I look. How do I look to people? And having to put on this face where internally we're devastated and barely surviving. And then there's the trauma of our country being split in half and colonized. And this is true of many Asian nations. There's multiple variables.
So many variables for each person, right, around what might be happening for them, the legacies, the family histories, and the histories of that particular person in terms of their ancestry and so many other things. And I think for Asian Americans, there is also this sort of the gaze of white supremacy, right? Kind of the imprint of that to our worth and to fitting into some mold. I was listening to someone speak, a mental health clinician who works at a university, and I don't remember the time of month, but she was saying, we had 4 suicides on campus this year, and all of them were Asian people. So it is something is happening, and I don't want to speculate on why, but multiple reasons. But I think I just maybe so appreciate you and other people who speak to it because it's so stigmatized and there's so much shame around it. And so, like 20 years after, what would you have wanted to tell yourself at that time, if you could sort of, I don't know, kind of. Or tell the somebody who might be having these thoughts in this moment.
Yeah, I've thought about it a lot, and I've written about it. What are the things that I would say? But when I think about it back then, I wish someone had just sat and listened and heard the venting and the frustration and the anxiety and the hurt without judging me. And I was lucky to have good people in my life, but I'm not sure that I had someone who was emotionally mature and had the skills to be able to really, really hear me. Because, I grew up with physical and verbal abuse at home. I was born and raised in Florida and experienced a lot of racism and bullying. And, the narrative that I believed was that I have to earn my stay, that everything good I do, I earn a few more days. Everything bad I do, I'm like interrupting the natural flow of things. I'm some kind of cosmic interruption. And so even Yin, like you hearing me say this is sacred and valuable. You investing into being curious and compassionate about what I went through. You even asking me that. And if someone had just sat with me, not with kind of a voyeuristic curiosity, but with a compassionate curiosity, said, I really want to know what you're going through, and then to care. Because there's that PACES study, the positive childhood experiences, because there's the ACEs and then there's the PCE, and there's like seven markers of what a child can have to build coping skills. And one of them was at least two non-parent adults in your life who really care for you. And when I think about it, did I really have someone like that? And I'm not 100% sure that I did. At the time, I had a youth pastor who became kind of like my college pastor, I guess, who really, really sat with me and helped me out. And he had maybe limited capacity. He wasn't a therapist, but he really sat and listened. So I'm so glad for that. So I think that's, if I could time travel, that's what I would do. Sit and listen.
Sometimes it's like these things that maybe we can offer people that we don't think it's much, just a text or a call or something that feel maybe not that significant or big, but it might mean so much to the other person that we are thinking of them, that we're curious about them.
When I first got a cell phone, you could do like free calls after 9 p.m. or something like that. This was when like we're like, I don't know, 10 cents a text or something. I would sometimes wait till 9 p.m. and then I would call somebody and I would say, hey, I'm about to read a book or just hang out here. Can you just stay on the phone with me? You don't even have to say anything. I just need to know somebody's there, So I might be washing my clothes or washing dishes, and this phone would just be open next to me. And every once in a while, I'd pick up and I'd be like, "Are you still there?" And they were still there. So that in itself, that gesture, you're right, it's so important.
And how brave of you to ask that, because I imagine so many of us want to ask that and want to have that present, that connection or need something, but it's so hard to ask.
Thanks, Yin. Can I go back to your point about the when you mentioned white supremacy and how that has affected Asian Americans in particular? I was thinking a lot about this. I have some Asian American friends who, and I'm talking second generation, who don't think mental health is a real thing. And, who will even tell me, like, I've never experienced racism in America. In the Asian world, there are those who are entrepreneurs and business type people. And sometimes when I have a conversation with them, it's like we're on completely two different frequencies. And it's almost like we both kind of grew up the same way. But so when I think about what they're telling me, to your point about white supremacy, because I don't want to blame just, oh, Eastern culture honor shame stuff, because I think honor is incredibly important. And so much of our culture is beautiful. I saw my parents struggle to climb Mount Assimilation, essentially. And so much of them having to hide to survive. And as you climb that mountain, as children of immigrants, as immigrants and children of immigrants climb that mountain, there's so much of ourselves that we have to give up in order to conform to blend to look like we're quote unquote safe and not troublemakers. And when you hide that way, it can become toxic in our bodies. There. I mean, there's a Korean market over here that will cater food to your business. And I remember I once got catering for my coworkers, and she leaned over to me. She was like 1.5 generation, and she said, "Hey, is this meat, is this going to be for like Koreans, or is it going to be for white people?" And I said, "Oh, why do you ask?" And she said, and she was being so polite. She was like, "Honestly, white people always complain because the way we make it, you know how bulgogi is, like Korean, you know, garlic beef. They say it's too much garlic. So we take away the garlic and we add more sugar." And I said, "Man, like they had to do that. You know what I mean? To assimilate. Like if we do it Americanized style, we get dissatisfied customers." So I think the people who, some Asian Americans who had to assimilate, when they get to this place where they're successful, quote unquote, the summit or peak of mountain assimilation, at the top of Mount Assimilate, they forget what the struggle's like. They just forgot. They had to hide themselves so much. So then they'll say things like, "I never experienced racism," or "No, you know, like that sort of thing." So much of that can cost our mental health.
We all assimilate to certain degrees. I think it's inevitable. Maybe it's not in our full awareness is what that cost of that assimilation is over time. And I think that's a particular kind of pain, which as you were talking, you made me think about, there's different ways to think about depression. You know, some people think about it as a chemical imbalance or not being connected to feelings, or there is some people that think it's like an aggression turned inwards. Some people think about it as it's a blockage of feelings, you know, like a depressive state is kind of a lack of aliveness. But it also could be like a lack of like not grieving properly, a melancholy, like a sadness that has no place to go. It just accumulates and becomes a sort of depressive kind of heavy state. And I think for so much of us of the diaspora, there is so much grief that has had no place to go because for whatever reasons or no language.
Yeah, you know, when we assimilate, we give up a part of our home. And when we give up a part of our home, we grieve that loss. And you're right in that maybe many Asian Americans don't know that that they've lost something in that, and that they didn't have the opportunity to grieve that.
I was talking to a friend. I was like, hey, if somebody came to my home and I wasn't here, do you think they would know I'm Asian? Like,
Wow. Yeah. Well, my front door looks like a shoe market because of all the shoes that are there. Hopefully, that's a giveaway.
yeah. I'll probably leave some shoes out there now. So. There was something I forgot to ask. I'm going to backtrack a little bit.
Course, yeah.
It's about your therapy experience because you shared that you have a new therapist now. But I was curious, maybe like how many therapists have you seen just in general, like.
Yeah, so before regular therapy, I think I saw maybe like when I was intermittently going, maybe 8 or 10 different therapists, something like that. And so it really wasn't regular. I would try and then I would try for a few months and then I would stop and then go again. And they were all so different. And finally, at the end of 2020, I got my first Asian American therapist. And wow, you know, what a difference that was. You know, because certainly there's a danger of like assumptions, you know, like when you're with another Asian person, maybe they got their own story. They just may assume that I have the same kind of thoughts as them, but you know, of course it's different. But there is a shared, connected, common language too. Yeah. And so that she could key in right away. And then I also had a trauma therapist at the same time who just recently retired. She did EMDR for me. And now I have a new therapist who she is also Asian American. Yeah, we just finished our second session. She's wonderful. And Ian, earlier, I think you were asking me about me wanting to be a therapist. Yeah, there's a part of me that still aches and longs for that. You know, I still read on like the mental health field almost every day, like psychology stuff. I love reading studies and all that kind of thing. Which I know studies have their own issues, but you know, but yeah, it's still very much a part of my work and life, and like I really, really champion the value of therapy.
I mean, from what you've told me and from what I heard about your training as a chaplain, like it is very similar. I don't like it. It's very, very similar. So I think you are a therapist. I'm just saying, I mean.
Oh, well, you're very kind. You know, I look up the therapist very much. I know that when I'm with a patient, there are certain things I cannot do, and I will recommend them to a therapist. I know that as a chaplain, I enter into crisis, into grief, and to like the hardest moment of somebody's life. And that's the part that I get to do. But I know that therapists, they are going to offer that long-term care, that therapeutic alliance that I feel like would be is valuable for
Yeah.
everyone.
But I think, sorry, I'm like, no, you are a therapist. But I think what I'm like, you made me think about the study that you said, you know, like how children or even adults might just need one or two experiences of someone really caring. And for some people, it was you in those last moments, you know. And for some people, it was a therapist, maybe that they've seen for a few months and stopped going for whatever reasons, or it might be a therapist that they've seen for 5 years. So I think that presence is so important that we don't know what could happen from that, from just being there with somebody in the real way. What was the difference for you? Because you said you went intermittently, you know, over the years. What felt different for you when you started going regularly?
Honestly, I think as a parent, I would not have been able to self-regulate as much because I needed to be able to have the coping skills and kind of the resiliency to self-regulate. Because, you know, my wife had about 5 months of PPD. Our daughter, in her first 5 months, we thought maybe she had colic because she was crying nonstop. And so, one thing that therapy really helped me with was being able to build the skill to be the husband and dad I needed. And I know that's a big statement to make, but I needed all the help that I could get. And I really, really got it. I mean, I attribute therapy probably to saving not just myself, but my whole family, you know? And so I think without my therapist guiding me through that, giving me a space to vent, to be frustrated, to say things that, like, you know, I probably wouldn't tell another soul, things that I felt ashamed and embarrassed about, but the therapist did not judge me for. That is huge. All of us, I believe, need that. And so having that regular place, that scheduled place, that sacred ground, yeah, I think it saved our lives.
Yeah, I so value my own therapy that I get to go every week as a place to kind of reflect, regulate, think, make meaning of. It is surprising what it can do.
I say this as a martial artist. I mean, when you are training and you're throwing kicks and you're conditioning and all that kind of stuff, you won't really know how it goes until you're in the ring and then you're facing off against somebody. So therapy is almost like life practice or life preparation. There's something about it where you're almost being guided along through your own thought life. And then when you come into real life at a decision point, there's almost like this voice of the therapist, but also your voice that you kind of worked out stuff with the therapist where you can almost make a different decision or a better decision. And then the thoughts that accompany that almost feel like, oh, I can manage this. And it's almost like a practice for life type thing. So I know that sounds very like life coach type,
No, not at all. It reminds me of,
but I've seen the difference.
yeah. It reminds me of a quote of this very sort of seasoned clinician who wrote many books, Nancy McWilliams. She talks about how therapy and sort of a deep listening and presence can help us build a psychic structure to bear life, which I think is what you're talking about. I wanted to ask a little bit about the birth of your second child. It's coming up, like very soon, I think, in a couple of weeks. Is that right? How exciting, I guess. I don't
Very
know.
exciting.
Yeah. Does the second one feel different than the first one,
Definitely
or
feels
not? It's
very, very different. I think there's more of a sense of I give you one example, and I think parents will immediately know what I mean. Like for the first child or the pregnancy, we were taking pictures every week of my wife's baby bump. I think this one we might have taken two pictures. There's a little bit more of a laid back, like, we got some experience now, and it's not that this isn't special, of course. It's just we feel a little bit more laid back about it. There's more confidence, I think.
I was thinking a little bit about your second child is coming, and you shared that with me, and this a chaplain who's, so confronted with death and dying, kind of like, I don't know, how do you think about birth in the in this context of death and dying?
That's such a profound thought, and maybe something I haven't given as much thought to, but I can say being in the hospital now, working there for almost nine, this year will be 9 years. I think I've seen thousands of lifetimes, from birth to death, from deliveries to deathbeds. And seeing all of that, there's a swiftness and almost like a such a brevity to and frailty to life, Maybe this is not an original thing to say, but the depth of appreciation that I have of like how quick it all goes. 'Cause I may go see an 80, 9-year-old patient who's basically on the way out, sitting at their deathbed. And then I'll be called to bless like a newborn. And so chaplains, we see every patient, every room, wherever we get requests. We work the whole hospital. So NICU or PICU or elderly care, all of it. And just seeing life that way, almost spread out on a table, so to speak. Gosh, it's quicker than you think. Yeah, and it's so fast. And sometimes I had one patient who, their baby had died. And so she wanted me to pray a prayer about the life that he never had. She's like, "Can you just tell me a story about that?" And so I did. In just a few sentences, I wove this story for her. That's what she needed. Life is as fast as a spoken word. The second you're born, it's going. And I really could picture this baby just growing up to become a grandfather, or a grandmother. Yeah. So, yeah, and I wish I had maybe a deeper answer, but I feel it deeply in my bones how fast it goes.
And I'm feeling something too. I don't know. Sometimes words don't quite capture it, Like I think as you're sharing that with me, I could feel like the preciousness of it and like kind of and the grief of maybe living too, because we all know in some ways where it leads.
We're all crossing this bridge, and as we cross it, the lights behind us turn off permanently. We can't go back. And so I'm seeing all of it, and it is a lot, and it does give me a depth of being present in every moment that I'm in, for sure.
You have a new book coming out in
Yeah.
May 2024. I think it's on
It
grief.
is, yes.
Is that right? It's on grief. What do you think it's a misunderstanding that people might have about grief that you want them to know or appreciate?
If there's one thing I can say about that that I've learned is that, well, maybe this is a two-part answer, but grief is not going to look like the way we might think it classically looks. You know, I think Hollywood has given a picture of grief being a very particular way, whether that's a polished type of crying or sadness, sorrow. But grief can look like a lot of different things. I've seen very expressive emotionalism to shutting down, not crying a tear, cognitive fog, being in the corner of the room, escaping into a phone. Now, are these two people grieving any better or worse? I would say that they're grieving the way that they need to in that moment, you know? And certainly there are healthy and unhealthy ways to grieve, but I think grieving can look like shouting and screaming, or it can even look like rolling on the floor or dancing or rocking the body back and forth. I've seen people clapping their hands or praying loudly or sitting still, numb and shocked. And so I think the range of grief can look very different. And I think grief in itself, I've grown up thinking that it was about letting go. That's kind of the popular narrative. But I do think grief is less about letting go, more about letting in the entire depth of that loss, everything that that loss meant. And not just loss of loved one. When we think of grief, maybe it's a death, but there's also death of our dreams, you know, the death of what could have been. There's all these other little losses that happen throughout life. Even good change involves loss when someone gets promoted or levels up in their life, you know? And so grieving all of that is embracing all of it and saying the sadness is a part of it, that it is okay that I am sad, that it is okay that I'm feeling this hurt and this pain. That's kind of, in my experience, what I've seen, that when someone suppresses it or denies it or says that it's about letting go and starting things fresh and starting things new. Now, for some people, that's going to be helpful, but for many people, it's rushed and it's fast and it's too much all at once. So how can we really experience it and let it in?
It's a whole range of emotions. It has its own time. It can look differently for different people. I'm looking at the time, and
Yeah.
thank you so much for your time, for sharing so openly with me and the work that you do. Sometimes I read your posts and I start tearing. So it is really, I think, helping people feel, and I think that's such an important part of being human.
Thank you, Ian.
If you enjoyed our conversation and found it helpful, please share it with a friend or a colleague or give it a 5-star review. Apparently, it helps others find the podcast. Until next time, take care.